talk show of its kind anywhere in the whole world. Have you ever dreamed about starting a business? Then this show is dedicated to you and for you. The show is for entrepreneurs, dreamers, investors, techies, and non-techies. Anyone and everyone that has a dream.
Our host, Rohit Chandra, himself has started several companies in Silicon Valley, raised millions of dollars in equity financing, and has inventions that are currently being used by hundreds of millions of users on the web.
Welcome. My name is Rohit Chandra, and I am the founder of a micro-information service on the web called Rohit.com, a service that I hope will one day transform the way you use the web. Yes, it's called Rohit.com. Tune in to KLOK 1170 every Saturday at noon, and we'll talk about everything it takes to build a company. Idea, recruiting, incorporation, market, bootstrapping, venture capital, intellectual property, and more. Tech businesses and non-tech businesses. We'll hear stories from people like you and me who have done this successfully. Call in and ask specific questions or generic questions and engage in a stimulating discussion about building a company. Sunna na bhuliye, har Saturday, dopehar 12 baje. Every Saturday at 12 noon.
बस इतना सा ख्वाब है।
सपने सलामत दोस्तों, वेलकम बैक सपने सलामत। यू आर लिसनिंग टू सपने सलामत विद रोहित चंद्रा। इट इज सैटरडे, इट इज नून, एंड इट इज टाइम टू स्टार्ट लिविंग आउट दोज ड्रीम्स। सो एज यू नो बाय नाउ, दिस इज अ शो दैट्स डेडिकेटेड टू एनीवन विद अ ड्रीम। दिस इज अ शो फॉर एंटरप्रेन्योर्स, फॉर ड्रीमर्स, फॉर इन्वेस्टर्स, फॉर टेक्निकल पीपल एंड नॉन टेक्निकल पीपल। This is a show for anyone and everyone that has a dream. And as you know, we are on every Saturday at noon. This is a non-commercial show with a singular goal to promote entrepreneurship and help you realize your dreams. So no money has been paid, no money has been received by anybody to make an appearance on today's show. As we've mentioned in the past, think of this show as a helpline for startups. And if you have a question, comment related to startups, we'll try to address it. If we can't, we'll defer it to somebody who can. So please feel free to call in at 408-912-KLOK. That's 408-912-5565. And folks, as always, remember, please turn your radios down when you call. And now, I've got a very, very exciting guest who's joining me in the studios today. Gentleman by the name of Ajay Shah. Ajay, welcome to the studio.
Well, thank you for having me.
No, real pleasure. So for the quick benefit of my listeners, I want to say Ajay is an entrepreneur who's been an entrepreneur. I guess he started a... Well, I won't go into the details. I'll just give you the teaser about Ajay. He started a company with $80,000 and it went on to being a $2.2 billion exit for him. So we'll discover that story as we go along. But most importantly, I first of all want to welcome to the studio, find out who he is, why he is here, and why he's done and how he's done what he's done. So lots of questions, Ajay. First... thank you for taking time out. Come out on a Saturday. We're going to dive in head first. What is your story? Where were you born? How did you get about? How did this all come about?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me again, Rohit. The reason I'm here today is just to have a bit of fun talking to people.
Yeah.
On a Saturday. It's always interesting to hear others. So a little bit about myself.
Where were you born?
I was born in a city called Kampala in Uganda.
Of course, I've been there.
And grew up in Kampala.
This is before the Idi Amin era?
I was born, yes, I'm old enough to be before the Idi Amin era, yes.
Yes.
But I was very young when Idi Amin came to power.
Did you ever go back there?
I've been all over Africa, especially Tanzania, which I love.
Yes, me too.
Kenya.
Kenya more than I love Tanzania, but it's
prefer
not
Tanzania,
the same.
To be honest. But yeah. Kenya I love too, and I have lots of relatives in Kenya.
Let me ask you a completely off-the-wall question. When I've gone to Kampala, I've seen storks sitting on garbage dumps in city center. I mean, is there a reason why there's storks in the heart of the city?
Well, they have to eat.
it's such a bizarre sight. I was in Kampala, there were storks
sitting on top of garbage.
They're beautiful. Actually, the most beautiful bird there is this, it's called the crested crane.
Yes.
It's a gorgeous bird. If you get a chance, just look it up on the web. It's a beautiful bird with a huge plume. Anyway, you didn't want to talk about birds, did you?
No, I didn't, but it's always interesting. See, there's something about Kampala. I've never talked to anybody about Kampala saying that, you know, I wasn't Kampala. In fact, if memory serves me right, Kampala has only one cinema hall or movie theater.
I think there's more than that.
Okay.
It's a good-sized city.
Yeah, but I saw only one, and guess what? It was only playing Bollywood movies, and I saw Yadin over there myself.
There's still quite a few people of Indian origin in Uganda, in Kampala. But, you know, a lot have left, and many people went to Canada, many people went to... of course, to the UK,
Germany is another place. Yes,
a few people in Germany. Yeah, all over the place.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's born in Kampala, then grew up mostly in boarding school in India.
Yeah.
And
whereabouts?
In a school called Lawrence School in Lovedale. If there are any Lovedale listeners, they've got to call in.
Okay.
So it's a boarding school near Ooty.
Yes, I've heard of the Lawrence School, but I've never... I can't...
There are two Lawrence Schools. One in Sanawar, one in Lovedale.
Yes.
And anyway...
Sanawar is the famous one. That's right. That's
no,
where
I think Lovedale is the famous one. But but anyway, so we have... I grew up there for quite a few years in boarding school and then went to college in Baroda.
Yeah.
Baroda for a few years in college.
What college was that?
The long name is Maharaja Sayajirao University of Baroda, engineering school.
Okay.
It's a relatively small engineering school, but quite popular. There's lots and lots of people from MS University, as it's called, here in, you know, who've done really well in the tech business, particularly.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Case in point, right? what happens after that? So you went to college in Baroda, you grew up there, and how did you end up in the U.S.?
After Baroda, I worked for a short while for Larsen & Toubro in Bombay, and then I came and did a master's degree at Stanford University, close by here.
Yes, very much. So there's another story in here that we never got into, which is the fact that you're actually one of those guys who got into the IITs and yet never joined.
Yeah, it was a bit of a long story, but my parents got divorced right about then.
Okay.
And I stayed with my mother, and she was in Baroda. My grandparents were in Baroda. So there was a...
Well, IITs is a big deal today, right? Especially for those of us that have not gone there.
IITs would have been great. It would have been a great choice. I would rather have gone to the IITs, probably. I will never know.
Yeah.
Frankly, Baroda was tremendous in terms of... I had a great time.
Yeah.
I got a little bit of education, too.
Hey, now, huh? Yeah, that's quite the secret, I think, from all engineering colleges. So you showed up at Stanford, and what did you major in? Computer science?
No, at Stanford, I did a management degree.
Okay, and what did you do in Baroda?
I did an engineering degree.
But what kind?
I'm a mechanical engineer in theory.
Okay.
But in practice, I've never done mechanical engineering for a day. I did do process engineering. I did, I did lots of different types of engineering, but not mechanical.
Yeah, yeah.
So, must be because I have really good mechanical engineering skills.
All right, so you came to Stanford, did your degree, and now what happens?
Oh, I joined the semiconductor industry. That was in boom period. This is the mid-80s.
Yeah.
So I joined the semiconductor industry first AMD.
Okay.
And at AMD, I was, as I was saying, I was a process engineer. My best job was I was a manufacturing supervisor. I actually ran a shift at a wafer fab. And I was literally 21, 22 years old. And I was running a wafer fab that had, 50, 60 employees, something like that.
So at 21, you'd already finished your graduate degree?
22 maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
22.
Yeah. All right.
So it was a great experience. Best experience, I think, was that experience. Because suddenly you got 50 people looking at you saying, so what are we doing?
And you're a 22-year-old kid.
Yeah. And they're thinking you're a kid.
Yeah. And you aren't?
Well, you're a kid.
Okay.
You better grow up quick.
Just checking. Okay. So, all right. Let's fast forward and talk about it. So you go from AMD to Samsung, and from Samsung... interesting things begin to happen.
Yeah, I was at AMD for 4 or 5 years. Actually, the interesting things happened at AMD because I then went to marketing.
Okay.
AMD gave me a great opportunity to be in 4 different departments. I started in engineering.
This is still back in the Jerry Sanders days, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Jerry, very colorful boss. It was tremendous, you know. They say Jerry Sanders is a marketing-driven guy. That's not true. Jerry Sanders is a sales-driven guy. Yeah. It's just about selling. Don't talk to me about what it is. Just sell it.
Where does Steve Jobs fit into that?
Well, Steve is an amazing product visionary, I think.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, there's only one of a kind, right? Like Steve Jobs.
He's not a sales guy?
No, I think Steve can sell, but at the heart of what Steve really is, he's a product visionary.
Not marketing either?
Well, he can market. You know, clearly he can do quite a few things.
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to trip you over. I'm just trying to get a perspective.
But at the heart of it, you have the ability to see around corners in terms of what kind of a product people will want.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the Mac or the iPhone or the
No, I completely agree with you. Exactly, to your point. You know, Mac came out with a whole concept of a user interface, which was a graphical user interface. Yeah. And they just didn't do such a good job of marketing it and selling it at the time. And now again, we look at the iPhone. It's the same thing. That the product visionary is what he's done. But except they've been able to execute really, really well this time
ruthless.
Around.
He's ruthless. He's amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, coming back to you. Yeah. So you got into AMD. You had spent 4 or 5 years at AMD.
Yeah, then I went into marketing at AMD. And they promoted me. So I became a marketing manager at AMD. It was a very interesting time because the market first took off and it was really strong. And then the next year, I had the experience of a market that collapsed. And the product line went from fabulously profitable to pretty much unprofitable just in 1 year.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it. It was the market.
Sure. So we'll go with that.
Tremendous learning experience again.
Yeah.
And, at the end of it, there was this startup, kind of. A big Korean company called Samsung was starting up its...
Yeah, I think some of us have heard of this startup. Yeah. Samsung,
was
right?
Was just starting up its semiconductor division.
Yeah.
And so they were looking for someone to run marketing for U.S. marketing for their semiconductor business.
Uh-huh.
I thought it'd be a really interesting opportunity. And so I joined Samsung in 87, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
Then
and you were a married guy at this point?
I got married just... as I joined Samsung. Yeah.
Okay. How did that come about?
Oh, Lata, who grew up in, she actually grew up more in Africa than I did.
Lata, who's your wife?
Lata, who's my wife, yes. Yeah. She grew up in Tanzania, in Kenya, they even grew up a little bit in London. So for like 12 years, she was in London. And then we met in London because she was friends with my cousin sister, and I used to visit my cousin sister quite often in London because my cousins in London.
Yeah.
And then we happened to meet, and things developed.
Yeah. Very good, very good. And so you joined Samsung, and now what happens?
We started I was at Samsung a couple of years, and then we got an idea to start a company. Mostly because Samsung didn't want to go into that business. This was a new area where memory boards were starting to become popular. I was responsible for memory marketing primarily.
Okay.
Samsung was a big memory manufacturer, still is a very big memory manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, right now we're sold out. This was 88, 89.
Mm-hmm.
And, we really don't need any additional ways by which to sell memory.
Yeah.
Because we're sold out. So I said, that doesn't last forever. In the memory business, I've figured out that what goes up must come down. And oh, by the way, what goes down must go up. it's a cycle. And so we started our business kind of at a point when, memory availability was very tough. And Samsung said, look, go ahead and start. We'll support you.
Yeah.
And they did. And they were very, very good partners. Still have lots of friends at Samsung because they've been
And so what were you building?
So we started building memory boards, for many small companies at the time. They were small companies. They became bigger and bigger and bigger.
And so let me stop you for a second here. So what was this company that you started?
The company's name was Smart Modular Technologies.
Yes.
We started with three different names, and then somehow Smart was the one that stuck.
Yeah.
We started.
And how many people started this company?
Three.
Okay.
You know, and Lata was the CFO. She was working.
Lata Krishnan.
Lata Krishnan, my wife, was working at that time for an investment bank in San Francisco called Montgomery Securities.
Yes.
And she decided that, you know, she'd joined the startup.
Yeah.
Mukesh, who was my colleague at Samsung, and before that at AMD, really smart, very sharp technical guy.
Yeah.
So the three of us joined. I was more marketing. Mukesh was more the product and the technical side. And Lata was more the financial side.
Yeah, yeah.
So we started this company, tried to raise a little bit of money. It was tough. People didn't really want to invest in the memory business, you know. And so we ended up with starting the company pretty much with our money and some family money.
And how much money was that?
Well, in total, it's about $80,000.
$80,000, okay.
So $80,000. I called my father-in-law among the various people, and I said, look, we're trying to raise a little bit of money. And he said, let me call a few friends, see if anyone, you know. So he and some of his friends, they kind of said, okay, young people, they're trying to do something good, help them out.
Yeah.
And so I got a little bit of help from a few different people that added up to $80,000.
So the entire help was some total of $80,000, okay.
It's a good amount of money, by the way, especially in late, for someone to personally say, all right, you know, I think I'm going to lose this money, but go ahead anyway.
Yeah.
So that was, and then we loaded up, we took a second loan on our house and that sort of thing. So
okay, you did that. So
yeah, we put in our own money as well.
Okay, so there is a little bit of more capital injection.
Yeah,
than
there was
venture.
Another $50,000. So that was our money.
Okay.
Everything we could raise from our house and that sort of thing.
So you certainly put your neck on the line on that one.
Yeah, yeah. My entire life, I've always taken the risk.
Yeah. And do you think it's a good idea?
Depends. If it works, it's a good idea.
Very well said. Very well said. If it works, it's a great idea. So, all right. And now what happens with this $80,000 and the plus $50,000? So you start a company called Smart Modular.
So Smart Modular started. By that time, of course, the cycle turned a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the economy started to go downward, which may sound like bad news. But it turned out to be good news in some ways.
Okay.
Because what we were able to do is to get real estate really cheap. In fact, we persuaded a company to rent us the space, sublease.
Yeah.
They had excess space. And to get paid when we had money.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're paying deferred rent. So that basically you said, I'll pay you rent when I have the
money. Yep, exactly. And
what
said,
a great
well,
way to do
well,
it. And is well, that something you did? Is that something that Lata did?
Well, actually, Lata did quite a bit of the financial side. Although some of this, you know, I went to people and I said, look, you've got excess space.
Yeah.
I need space. I'll use it. At least I'll maintain it and pay for utilities and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'll try and pay you rent as soon as I have money.
And they fell for that.
They fell for it. It was pretty good.
Well, there's no reason.
You know, by the way, I offered him equity.
Yeah.
And he said, no thanks.
Yeah.
Oh, well. He still remembers it. Yeah. It's a guy called Baldev Krishan, one of the early entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley.
Real estate entrepreneur?
No, not real estate. He started a company, I think it was called Omnitel.
Yes, I recall that.
Yeah, in Fremont. And Baldev, you know, said he was really nice. I mean, I think part of it was just that he was a nice guy. And he said, young people trying to start a company, help him out a little.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break and we're going to continue talking about the story of how $80,000 converted into a $2.2 billion exit. We're talking today with Ajay Shah on Sapne Salamat with Rohit Chandra.
Vinu Prashar, CPA for professionals and small business owners. Vinu Prashar has more than 20 years of experience in taxes, finance, and accounting for individuals and for businesses. Work with the best round the year for major life events, tax planning, and tax filing. Expect excellent service, quality, trust, and integrity, all at a good value. You can reach Vinu at 650-722-2021 or on the web at www.prasharcpa.com.
Vinu Prashar, CPA, is an accounting and tax professional and a member of AICPA and CalCPA.
Vinu Prashar, CPA for professionals and small business owners.
behind on or having difficulty making your mortgage payments? If you or anyone you know is facing foreclosure and looking for answers, please contact us right away for a free consultation. Contact Sean Nasir, 209-603-3737, or go to www.georealtyusa.com. That's georealtyusa.com. California Department of Real Estate, license number 01475435.
Sapna Salamat, welcome back. We are talking with Ajay Shah about how $80,000 gets converted into $2.2 billion. Just before the break, Ajay was talking about how they were able to get real estate on a deferred basis. So I think in a bad economy, there's no reason why entrepreneurs today cannot do the exact same thing. Because when I drive down 880, there's so many buildings vacant sitting with four lease signs out there.
I think so too. I mean, you have to look at the downside as how do I use it?
Yeah.
You know, as an entrepreneur, the bottom line is you got to use what you got.
Yeah.
And you got to find what you got.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
you don't know what you have.
Yeah.
So the other part of it was equipment vendors. We decided we would actually be a manufacturer, not only a designer and marketer. So we decided to manufacture because our manufacturing was kind of specialized. And so we needed equipment.
Yeah.
And the same thing, you know, Lata worked really hard with the vendors. They had excess equipment. We said, look, we'll pay you per use. And they said, well, you know, how do we know how much you're going to use it? Well, you don't know. But, you know, I've got this business, that business coming.
Yeah.
And this customer is promising that they'll be ramping up soon. And so, hey, you know, and your machine is doing nothing. So what do you want to do? We got a lot of equipment on loan, if you will, and we were paying on a per use.
Interesting. And this is a very expensive equipment to acquire otherwise.
Yeah, fairly expensive. Yeah, I think it ended up costing, you know, a couple of $1 million in when we finally did buy it.
Okay.
Because we also had a deal that, you know, once we paid you so much, we can essentially buy the equipment.
Okay, okay.
So we had a highly variable cost structure.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is something that I think people should think about quite a bit. How to variabilize the cost structure.
Yeah. So you don't have, which in plain English is saying that don't have high fixed costs.
Yeah.
Where you have to pay so much in rent and so much for this and so much for that. So just some way that if
exactly.
If your revenues fall short or if the going gets tough, you can actually turn the dial down on your expenses.
And you don't need huge amounts of money to start.
Yeah.
You know, you can start by essentially having a more variable cost structure, and that allows you to grow with your business.
Yeah.
And yeah, the variable cost structure might not be the lowest cost.
Yeah.
But that's okay. You know, you can as your volume is there and your business develops,
yeah.
you can always find ways to reduce your cost.
Yeah. So let me do a little bit of fast forwarding and a little bit of rewinding at the same time. So you started the company, you've got $80,000 you've taken, and you're starting to build revenues. How come you didn't go to venture? Everybody in Silicon Valley talks about VCs and venture capital.
Yeah, well, we were fortunate. Okay, 3 months into the company, we were profitable.
Okay.
And generating cash.
Okay.
And we were plowing it back. And by that time, banks were starting to notice that our business was doing pretty well.
Okay.
And so they were willing to...
When you say notice they're doing pretty well, give me some numbers.
You know, in the first year, while we started a little slow, by the end of the first year, we'd done $3 million in revenue.
Okay.
Which may not sound like that
much. No, it doesn't sound like that much at all, especially for a bank.
But we were profitable.
Yeah.
And, you know, by that time, things were moving and there was backlog and, you know.
Yeah.
So as a result, many of the banks were starting to lend based on receivables.
Yeah.
Based on inventory.
Yeah.
You know, so we started to have other sources of financing. And so when you have other sources of financing and, you know, you're keeping your equity,
yeah.
Well, we didn't see any reason why we needed a VC.
I'm sure the VC saw a reason why they needed you at that point then.
Well, we were not that high profile. No, it wasn't
hang
like...
Hang on. Explain that to me. You say we are high profile that the banks are noticing us, but we are not high profile that the VCs are not noticing us?
Yeah, the banks are looking for low risk, right? They're looking for much less risk.
Yeah, but the banks have a... next to zero radar. They're not looking for people to...
Yeah, but Lata did a really good job in getting banks. You know, there was Imperial. There were a couple of banks, Silicon Valley Bank. They were involved. They looked at what we were doing. They liked it. And they were willing to take chances with a well securitized, you know, as they like it.
Yeah.
With receivables, inventories, well securitized.
Yeah. But okay. So you never went soliciting for funds on Sandy?
Not really. Then they started calling.
Oh, so the VCs were calling you?
Yeah, a few years later. Not maybe it was, you know, because our revenue grew very quickly.
Yeah.
From 3 to 10 to, you know, so we were growing pretty fast. And then the VCs started calling.
And now, what did you say to them?
But we were very profitable. I didn't need them.
Okay. So what happened with the company now?
Oh, we grew like mad, right? So we grew, we were in the right place at the right time, which is a good thing if you can manage that.
Yeah.
And we grew from 10 to, I forget, 16 to 80. And then by the fifth year, I think we were doing 250 million in revenue. So we grew very, very quickly. And in many cases, we got our customers to finance us.
Customers are fine. Okay. And so finally, you took the company public.
95, we finally went public.
Okay. So you started in 87. 8 years later.
No, we started 89.
So 6 years.
Yeah, 5, 6 years.
Five or 6 years. That's a pretty good time. So question is, you did not need money. You did not take VC money. You had all the money you needed. Then why go public?
It's actually a very good question. This is a point for entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs that I talk to many times say, oh, then I went public. It's like going to heaven or something. And then you know, what
there's
else?
A reason why I asked this question, because I want you to share your insights on this whole perspective.
I think going public is more work. You know, it yeah. helps you if you have employees that are looking to you know, find the value of maybe stock options, that kind of thing. It helps you when you have customers that are looking for more credible supplier. It helps you when you have financial sources, you know, that you can draw on for acquisitions.
Yeah.
But it doesn't help you, in my view, with significant liquidity in the short term. Because in the short term, I mean, we owned almost all of the company. And, you know, we didn't get much liquidity.
Wait, didn't somebody invest $80,000 in your company?
Well, they got some.
There's a story there that I recall you telling me about the other day. And I think it's a fantastic story. I really loved that. I would love to hear it in your words.
I think you're referring to, the $80,000, as I told you, my father-in-law helped with just finding some of his friends who invested.
Yeah.
One was in London. There was a Dr. Sharma. Yeah. I think he invested $30,000 out of the $80,000. He was probably the largest. And Dr. Sharma did it because he's just a nice guy.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was not much more than that.
Yeah.
Maybe he liked me. I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah.
But he said, okay. And then he forgot about it.
Yeah.
And then 1995, we filed to go public.
Yeah.
So our underwriters, you know, started to call all the big investors and say you got to sign a lockup agreement, which is a normal part of when you're going public.
Which in plain English basically means that you cannot sell your shares for the
first
6 months.
You can't sell your shares for 6 months, exactly. So they,
and that is done because we don't want the people that have actually been part of the founding team to start getting rid of their shares and to prevent people...
And they want to manage the liquidity, right?
Exactly.
Sometimes they'll release it later.
Yeah.
But the point is, Dr. Sharma got a phone call and he called me and he said, "Yeh kya ho raha hai? You look... kya baat kar rahe hai, ye lock up, ye kya ho raha hai? Kuch kharab to nahi ho raha hai."
Exactly.
Nahin, nothing bad, Dr. Sharma, everything is good, don't worry. You know, we're just filing to go public.
And, exactly.
And he said, "Acha, so tell me a little bit more." And he didn't understand, so he got a financial guy who, you know, helped him out, did his taxes or something, to talk to me. And he didn't, you know, it was pretty amazing because his $30,000 was in the public markets at the filing price, going to be worth about $50 to $60 million. So,
$30,000. I like how you say it, $50 to $60,000, as if even, you know, $10 million here and there is no big deal for a guy who puts in $30,000.
So it was pretty amazing.
No, that's a fantastic outcome, and this is at the price it's going public at. We haven't yet factored in whether the stock's going to go up or beyond that or not, or what's going to happen.
Well, it went through a tortured route. Went up, went down, went up, went down.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we went public in 95 at, what was it, about $8 to $10 a share.
Yeah.
And that same share in late 99 was acquired for $60 a share.
Wow. So at one point, just to make it exciting for the audience, we are saying a multiple of about 8. Wow. I can't even do the math. So like $400 or $500 million is. So this $30,000 investment turned into $400 million.
Not quite, but
at its peak, as well.
Yeah, I think it was a little less than that. But it was, it was pretty good return.
That's ungodly. That's completely ungodly. All right, and so you did that, and Smart Modular went public with a market cap of how much?
250, 300 million.
And you then later on subsequently actually sold this public company to Solectron.
Yeah, so we sold the public company to another public company called Solectron. They were much bigger than us, maybe 4 or 5 times bigger than us. By that time, we were doing about $1 billion in revenue. So we had grown, even after we went public.
$1 billion in annual revenues.
In annual revenues, yeah.
That's fantastic.
We'd grown quite quickly, it was doing well. And we were very profitable as well.
Yeah.
We'd never had an unprofitable year, by the way.
I mean, just to put it in perspective, I don't think even Facebook is doing $1 billion in revenues today, and certainly not Twitter or any of the. And I think if I remember my numbers correctly, if folks feel free to correct me, I think Google is doing about a couple of billion a quarter at this point.
No, bigger than that. But I mean, this is, it's not directly comparable.
No, I understand.
We were a semiconductor hardware company as opposed to a software company or an internet company, because the revenues are different, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the margins are also different.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Facebook's an amazing company. Google is beyond phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
We built a nice business. It was good.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to continue talking with Ajay Shah, founder of Smart Modular Technologies.
Hey, BV, did you go through all those articles I sent you yesterday?
Itne sare kaam, ghar ka kaam karun, beti ka homework karun, kya kya karun, kab padun?
They were important articles, some on the school, the company, the community. You need to go through those.
Those are such long articles. Don't send me anything unless you highlight it.
Highlight it?
Do you not know about Ruhit? Use Ruhit and highlight.
Oh, maaf kijiye bhai. Main next time karta hoon.
Ruhit is a free, no sign up, no download web tool that allows you to highlight any part of any web page. ROOHIT.com.
If you want me to read it, use Ruhit.
Do you ever search for information on the web? Do you ever use Yahoo or Google or any other search engine? Well, guess what? Every time you search, there's only parts of certain pages that are of interest to you. Use Ruhit.com to highlight the parts that are of interest to you. And everything that you highlight is automatically saved and collected for you. See all of your web research consolidated in one place. Ruhit.com is a no sign up, no joining, free, no download service.
If you'd like to reach a large audience of engineers, technical people, marketing people, biz dev folks, PR people, this is the show to advertise on. You can reach us at 408-469-4192 or on radio@ruhit.com.
Vinu Prashar, CPA for professionals and small business owners. Vinu Prashar has more than 20 years of experience in taxes, finance, and accounting for individuals and for businesses. Work with the best round the year for major life events, tax planning, and tax filing. Expect excellent service, quality, trust, and integrity, all at a good value. You can reach Vinu at 650-722-2021 or on the web at www.prasharcpa.com.
Vinu Prashar, CPA, is an accounting and tax professional and a member of AICPA and CalCPA.
Vinu Prashar, CPA for professionals and small business owners.
Sapne Salamat, dosto. Welcome back. You're listening to Sapne Salamat with Rohit Chandra. Today we have in the studios with us Ajay Shah, founder of Smart Modular Technologies. Started the company with $80,000, took it public with a market cap of $250 million. Eventually sold it to Solectron for $2.2 billion. Huh?
Yeah, well, two things. We had done quite well. We were quite profitable. And it was late 99.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people were very acquisitive and people were looking to grow through acquisitions. Valuations were quite high. People remember the late 90s.
Yes.
And so it seemed like a good time to sell a business.
Yeah. No. Fantastic. Okay. And once you sold this company for $2.2 billion, you joined Solectron. You stayed with Solectron for a period of time.
For 2 years.
You also joined the board of directors, if I remember correctly.
I also joined the board of directors, yeah.
Okay. and you eventually left Selectron.
I left Selectron, yeah. I left I was called president of Selectron, and then I did that for, 2 years? And then I was on the board for another 6 months or something. So I left by end of 2002, early 2003, I had sort of finished up there.
What was Selectron's market cap while you were there at peak market cap?
Oh, there's a big number difference between the peak.
That's why it's peak.
Yeah, when they acquired us, I think the market cap was 15 billion or something, 13 billion, something like that.
Okay.
And then it went up maybe to 20. Then it came back down all the way to like 3.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So you were the president. So you left Selectron. And now what did you do after you left Selectron?
So I started up an investment company. I started up with some transactions. We acquired Fairchild Test, which was then called NP Test.
Right.
Which was a couple of $100 million test systems business.
Yeah.
Then we later sold that. We did a number of investments with some partners and myself.
Okay.
Just leading that investment.
Some partners and yourself were buying a company for $200 million of their own money, basically.
Yeah, although remember, we used some debt.
Yeah.
The purchase price is $200, but we don't actually put $200 of our own money in it.
How much of our own money goes into
it? Well, the debt then was, I think, $100 plus. So overall purchase price in terms of equity was $125, something like that.
Okay.
Quite a few partners that participated. I, of course, participated.
Yeah.
I was one of the leaders.
Yeah. And what did you do with this company?
And that eventually got sold to Credence. It went public.
Okay.
NP Test went public 2 years later, a year and a half later. And it was doing much better by then.
Yeah.
And then we sold it to Credence for a pretty good return.
How much?
I think we sold it for $400-500. Yeah.
So kind of doubled your money?
Yeah, more than, because the debt doesn't double, so the equity more than doubles.
So kind of quadrupled your money?
Probably, yeah, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to throw that out there so the folks listening in can actually relate to that and understand that whole concept that when you've taken a piece of debt, there you're just sort of, it's a debt that you pay off and you still have retained the ownership. So
of course, if it doesn't go well.
Yes, you're on the hook for it.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. But I think it's just much like you buy a house. You know, you put 20% down for $1 million home. If it becomes a $2 million home, you've only put $200,000 down.
Exactly.
But you've actually done a 6x return on that $200.
That's the good news of leverage.
Yeah, exactly.
The bad news of leverage is when the value goes down, as many people have felt in the last year or two.
Right.
Things don't always go well.
Right.
I think using the sensible amount of leverage is a very good way to manage financially.
Yeah.
And, if you over-leverage, then yes, you're taking a risk.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to open up the phone lines in 5 minutes. So folks that have been holding on to those calls may call in about 5 minutes. Phone number to the studios is 408-912-5565. That's 408-912-5565. So Ajay, there's still a very interesting story coming up over here. $80,000 went in, IPO'd at $250 million, sold the same company for $2.2 billion. And then what happened?
I think you're referring to, so Selectron got into more trouble. Things didn't go so well for Selectron.
Give me the short version first. You know where I'm going with this.
Well, so yeah, we ended up buying Smart Modular Technologies back from Selectron.
For?
At the time, it was like 110, 120 million, something like that.
Okay. So $80,000 goes to 250 million, goes to 2.2 billion, which is what you sell it for. And then you buy it back from the company that you sold it to for $110 million.
It's about right, yeah. we bought it back 2004.
Yeah.
And then we ended up taking the company public. In 2006, Smart Modular went back public again.
Again, okay.
And today it's a public company doing very well with its own management team. I'm no longer the CEO.
You're no longer the CEO. And
I am called the chairman, which means I don't do much.
And what is its market cap now?
Smart is maybe 400, 450 million market cap today.
Okay. So 110 to 450, not bad. And I guess it's seen some ups and downs in that market cap as well.
Yeah, it went up to 700, 800, came back down. You know, this is the normal track of the stock market. But the company's a good, very strong company. Well, good management team that's running it. And, it's almost $1 billion in revenue again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got a call coming in. I'm going to grab that real quick. And Sapne Salamat, you're live on air.
Hi, Rohit. Sapne Salamat.
Yes, go ahead, caller.
I'm calling from Milpitas, Rohit. I won't be able to disclose my name. I'll try to give my current situation.
Go ahead.
And this question is actually for Ajay Shah.
Go ahead.
I'm a hardware engineer by profession, Ajay, and I'm currently employed by a company. But under the stealth mode, I'm trying to launch my startup. My startup is not yet formed, and I was planning to launch in the consumer internet space. I have a business idea. I take this business idea to the venture capitalist. They like the idea. They invite me to the office. They say, show me the prototype. I say, show me the funding. So this is the kind of deadlock that I'm facing with the venture capitalist people. So I would like to take your advice on it. How can I resolve this deadlock?
It's questions for Ajay, even though I'm the consumer internet guy, but Ajay, go for it.
Well, you know, as usual, I think that you do have to show them the business plan. In my opinion, you know, I don't see how you can expect them to fund you without seeing the full details of the business plan. You know, if you were on the other end of that conversation and someone was saying, hey, I have this great idea, give me the funding and then I'll show you the idea, that wouldn't work too well.
No, Ajay, actually, I have the business plan, I have the business model, but I don't have the working prototype of the business idea or the plan. I obviously show them the business idea, the plan, they like the idea, they see the potential in it, but they tell me that we would love to see a prototype and some traction over it.
That's typical. I mean, they are financial investors, they're looking to reduce their risk. You know, it's not unusual for a venture capitalist to want to see a little bit more development. And, you know, while you're working at this other company, maybe you'd be able to do this in the evenings or something. Get it to the point where you can show them that it's a working prototype. You know, get it to where it looks more real. That's what you have to do.
Yeah. Let me give you a quick response and a reality check on that one, caller. Consumer
sure.
Internet, most VCs today will not fund without a significant piece of traction. Because consumer
okay.
web is a beast that most people do not understand. And the only way the validation they can get is from some traction. So you're
okay.
talking about a prototype. I would be shocked if you could get it with a working prototype. They don't want a prototype. They actually want a working product with traction, with users behind it. And to do that, they'll say the cost of capital to put the piece together today is significantly low. They will tell you, talk to your friends and family, go get some angel money and go do it and come back and do it. So VCs
okay.
will try to eliminate the risk. Is that not what they've already told you?
Somewhat, actually.
Exactly. That's what they're going to tell you because you're just going to say, hey, I'm giving you an opportunity to invest. You should be grasping and grabbing this opportunity. And they're on the other hand pushing you back and saying, no, go away, go get money from somebody else.
Right.
So that's the harsh reality. That's the way consumer
okay.
web is. Anyways, thank you for your question. My switchboard is lit up. I'm going to try and grab a couple of other calls before I let you go. But if you need more follow-up, feel free to send up an email to radio@rohit.com. That's radio@rohit.com. Since
yes,
I don't know your name.
Pleasure talking to you, Rohit and Ajay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Sapne Salamat, you're live on air.
Hi, this is Amit.
Sapne Salamat, Amit.
I have a question for Mr. Ajay Shah.
Yes, fire away.
Yeah, Mr. Ajay Shah, this is Amit. I don't know if you remember me, but I met you.
Go ahead with your question, caller.
Yeah, I have a product, you know, one gentleman just says I don't have a prototype, but I have a product, basically, and the product is already launched, but only thing is I need a lot of marketing dollars, I don't know how to approach the VCs, and Indians, they don't give a damn to me, my product, because I don't know, probably it's ego or whatever, so I really need a little guidance how I can approach the VCs.
Have you put together a business plan?
Yes, I do. And the product is launched already. People have started subscribing it. It's a SaaS product.
Well, you are in a good position to be able to show something well. So my suggestion is to draft a business plan and pull it together. Try and go talk to a few VCs. I don't think the VCs are opposed to finding new ideas. In fact, that's their job. Their job is to find new ideas and to evaluate them, to find a way to bring them to life. And so what you're describing suggests to me that you should package it properly, show how you're planning to develop it, and try and, you know, reach out through a network, however that might be, to a variety of VCs who are interested in this space.
Will you be interested in looking at it if you give me 5 minutes' time?
I have a suggestion for you, Amit. Why don't you send me an email to radio@rohit.com? I'd be happy to forward it on to Ajay and we'll let him decide from that point on.
I just ask him a question. If he says he's too busy, I understand. Please.